Chapter 7. The bus from Nashville to LA.
It was really bad for the last 2 years, and I wanted to check out. I had every fucking reason to want to. I mean, it was too painful to be sober. Too much pain.
If you don't have something to keep you focused or some kind of purpose, it's hard out there. Life is not easy. Who doesn't want to be high? Drugs or drinking make you feel great. You have to have something bigger than that feeling of being high, bigger than that happiness, bigger than that emptiness. If you don't, you're in trouble. Before I became addicted, I was focused. I wanted to know what the fuck I was doing here. I wanted to know about life. I wanted to know about people. For a long time, I didn't want to fuck around. I needed answers, whatever they were. That had been my focus. But as soon as that was gone, I was off the rails. When I had my twins and I was in the hospital and they gave me Norco, that's when I felt the first, oh my God, high from a painkiller. I was 40. I don't really know what I was doing, to be honest. I was getting isolated, slowly starting to get rid of everyone and everything in my life. All the pillars I had set up, all the people and the friends and the relationships, I was starting to, one by one, dislodge and dismantle each and every one of those things.
My mother had started by taking opioids for the pain after her C-section, and then she progressed to taking them to sleep. She had turned 40 in February 2008. My sisters were born in October that same year. I would turn 20 the following May. After her brief stint with drugs as a teenager, she had never touched them again. She drank, but like she said, as an adult, she wouldn't even take Advil or Tylenol. Throughout my life, she would often say, "If I tried drugs, it would be over for me." I see now that that was such a strong hint to an addiction issue she had an intuition about. I think it was subconscious, but it stalked her. She had been holding it back with Scientology, with raising children, with marriages, with spirituality. But it was there, like a shadow, the whole time. She'd say, "My dad was 42 when he died, I'm 39. We never could have imagined it would be something that would come for her so viciously, so late in life. Shortly after my sisters were born, to try to gain some agency, my mom moved with them and Michael Lockwood to England. Initially, they lived briefly in Southwest London, Richmond, and some days she would take my sisters in their stroller to a little crepe restaurant on the Thames. My mom loved the quaint life she was creating for herself. Ben and I felt a bit abandoned because her move to England meant that, for the first time, we didn't all live together in the same house. She got us a house in Calabasas, but we pretty much stayed in England with her most of the time. My mom had originally thought about living in Ireland. We would go to Ireland a lot when we were younger. My mom was friends with the Austrian-Irish artist Gottfried Helwein, and we'd stay at his castle, Castle Gertin in Kilsheelan, a few miles east of Clonmel. We'd all go to the local pubs and dance to the music. And then when closing time came, we'd head back to Gertin and run around the castle grounds, or climb a spiral tower to the top and lay under the stars, me drunk at 17, until the sun peered through the crenellations. So my mom had really wanted to move to Ireland, but every property she found, she claimed was haunted. She had a very practical and pragmatic connection to ghosts, past lives, spirits. One day, a realtor took us to a very old house somewhere outside of Cork. She led us down a hallway with pink floral wallpaper and a very low ceiling. Before we even reached the living room, my mom said, "It's haunted," turned around, and walked right out. She soon settled on England instead. In the beginning, England, like Hidden Hills before it, was really magical, the first couple of years especially. It seemed to me that she thought this was her last shot at stability. Once more having children and living in a huge country house in the middle of nowhere. Again, she was trying to recreate what she had felt with my father. a simple life without all the people, just her husband and her children. After Richmond in 2010, she bought a 15th century property in Rotherfield, about 30 miles northeast of Brighton on the south coast. The house had 50 acres, a gorgeous lake, sheep, horses, topiary, even an orangery. It was truly beautiful, stunning. It was also haunted, but only in one room. Finley told my mother and Michael that she often saw a man in her bedroom. Eventually, my mother and Michael got more details. Apparently, the great-grandmother of a resident of the house had lived and died in the house. And the loud bangs that they all regularly heard around midnight were probably to do with the great-grandfather who shot himself in the barn many years earlier, the same barn that was now their living room. My mom got very into gardening in England. She would plant radishes, potatoes, and carrots in the garden with my sisters. It was also the first time she cooked. She still had a chef, but she had more time on her hands, so spent some of it in the kitchen. We would take tea by the fire all day, too. She loved making and stoking fires. She would just sit there and intently watch the flames, trying to predict them. No one could make a fire blaze like my mother. She was a fire witch. Every weekend, Ben and I would take the train up to London to meet up with our friends. At Christmas time, we'd head to Harrods in Knightsbridge or to the Borough Market in Southwark. We'd do our Christmas shopping, then head back to our local pub in Crowborough, a few miles from the house, and hang out with the locals and sing and dance until the wee hours of the morning. By this time, my mom had become close friends with the owners of the pub, so we could skirt the 11 p.m. closing bell and stay all night. Ben was 18, and sometimes he'd work behind the bar. This was my mom's idea of living a small life. She still had a house manager, one security guard, one driver, a chef, and two nannies for the girls, which sounds like a lot, but it was a skeleton crew compared to what had been going on in California. Eventually, she created her own pub at the house where a bunch of the locals, including some new friends like Jeff Beck and his wife Sandra and Sarah Ferguson, could hang out. Sarah and my mom had a real loyalty toward each other. They'd both been through similar onslaughts in the press and in life, torn apart and shamed simply for being women who were unapologetically themselves. And my mom had huge Christmas parties, too. Mostly, though, she liked going to the chip shop and having a roast on Sundays and gardening with my sisters. Seemingly, she had done what she set out to do. She had created a very sweet little life in the countryside. So the first couple years were truly magical. We had no idea, though, that her pill use was very slowly increasing. One night, we all went up to London to hang out at Soho House. Typically, when my mother and I got into fights, they would resolve themselves fairly quickly. She could be rational, could take responsibility, and be empathetic. That night at Soho House, though, was the first time I realized something was wrong. It began as a small argument about me wanting to go to Ireland before Christmas, but quickly I felt a viciousness from her I'd never felt before. She wouldn't resolve the argument, and the back and forth felt very irrational. "You didn't tell me you were going to Ireland this close to Christmas," she said. "Yes, I did tell you," I said. "You just don't remember." She ignored that. "So you're going to leave me here and take your brother to Ireland? That's just so not right, so not okay to do that." "I just told you. I told you weeks ago we were going to Ireland. I'm so confused right now." She became relentless. She wouldn't let it go. There was a new meanness in her where before we would have resolved it quickly. I was so confused and angry at the exchange that I stormed out of the club. It had made me feel crazy. On my way out, I found my brother having a cigarette. "Mom is being so weird," I said. "What do you mean?" he said. "Like she's just getting mad that we're going to Ireland when we already told her weeks ago. She won't let it go." I was dressed in a fancy gown, and I had nowhere to go. It was 2 a.m. As I walked away, a rickshaw passed me, and I got in. The rickshaw was all decked out in Christmas lights, and the guy was blasting Angels by Robbie Williams so loud I couldn't hear myself think. There I was, dressed in a floor-length gown and a faux fur coat. And even in my fury, I couldn't help but see the absurdity of the situation and laugh at myself. I texted my mom a video of me riding through Oxford Circus as the song blasted. My mother sent a text back. Ha. After fights, we wouldn't typically have a conversation to resolve the fight. Eventually, one person would just break the silence and it was back to business as usual. This was that text. I headed back to Soho House. But things were changing. And not just with my mom. After a couple of years living in England, we all went to Hawaii on vacation. And that's when my mom admitted to me that yes, she was addicted to opioids, but that she was planning on going to rehab in Mexico. Me and my brother and sisters went to Mexico with her. Halfway through, though, she made an excuse to cut it short. I'm gonna have to go back. The girls are starting school after Easter, she said. What do you mean? I said. Surely you knew this was landing on those dates. Yeah, but they just started. They have all these new friends. They have their routine. I'm not gonna pull them out of that. I think everyone would agree that you staying here is more important than my sister's missing a week of school, I said. But she was adamant. She always did what she wanted to do. My brother and I were angry, but we couldn't change her mind. Back in England, there was a tacit awareness between me, my brother, and Michael that maybe my mother didn't want to get sober. She was always extremely honest. But I think she felt that being honest was the virtue, rather than the changing of her behavior. Since she had admitted it to us, the honesty seemed to give her the license to continue with her addiction. Now that we knew, my brother and I noticed things, like she would fall asleep too early when we watched movies together. One morning, I was sitting in the kitchen drinking tea, and as my mom came by, she slightly bumped into the wall as she passed. I felt a sense of dread, because I knew from her telling me for years and years that if she ever did heroin, it would kill her. She would say, I would never just dabble. If I did it, it would take me out. Eventually, she realized that moving to England hadn't been such a good idea. She had distanced herself from all of her friends, and the drug use had increased along with the loneliness and isolation. Or she needed to be alone to take the drugs, or both. Her community was gone. She was in the English countryside with two babies and no friends. She decided that isolation was the problem. She hated LA and wanted to be closer to Graceland, so she decided she was going to move to Nashville to be more social and make a new record. I felt better. This felt like she had a plan. Danny was going to try to sell the house in England, and she was going to get off the pills and start over in Nashville. While she looked for Nashville homes, she rented a house in LA, on a golf course with a beautiful backyard, a pool, and a movie room where my brother and I would watch Game of Thrones. One night, I went downstairs to get a drink, and I noticed that Michael was taking my sisters out of the house to Chuck E. Cheese. It was strange that my mom wasn't going with them. I went upstairs to find her and headed into her room. I realized that she was hiding in the bathroom. Don't come in, she said. I ignored her. When I entered, I found her crying in her bathtub. She had a black eye and a bloody nose. She'd fallen while high. She was sobbing and clearly felt ashamed. She told Michael to take my sisters out so they wouldn't see her face. She knew this had all gone too far. And she went back to rehab the following week. After that stint, she then flew to Nashville. My mother was slowly falling apart. My brother was too. We were all drinking a lot, but even when he drank, my brother remained jovial, fun. He was somebody who never wanted the night to end, the last person awake. But there was one night at a club when I was around 22, and Ben started pushing me to leave. It didn't feel right. He got me in a taxi and sent me back to the hotel where we were staying for the weekend. Only later did I realize he'd been doing drugs, probably Molly or coke. And he had wanted me out of there so he could do whatever he wanted without me finding out. This became a theme in my family. They would do things behind my back. I was kind of the narc. My mom always said I was too harsh on Ben or too harsh on her. But I think it was simply that I was the only one who wasn't an addict, so I was a downer. But I was getting concerned about Ben. One night, around that time, he was drinking at the pub, came back late, and fell off his bed and chipped his front tooth. He cried in my mom's arms that night at the bottom of the stairs. Still, he never really drank during the day. He was a binge drinker, going hard for a couple of weeks and then stopping for a long stretch. We got a lot of time with him sober. I would worry about him in the moment, but then the following week or month he'd be fine, better than fine, drinking green juices and working out. It didn't affect my relationship with him, but my mom's addiction meant she was simply not there emotionally a lot of the time.
When I started talking to a therapist, it was really nice to hear somebody talk back and say, "Hey, you're not fucked up," or "You need to stop shooting yourself in the foot." I also attended group therapy, and initially, I really resisted it. But eventually, I started getting close to people. I realized that they were all as fucked up as me. I didn't love AA. You talk about drugs and alcohol all the time, and it drives me fucking crazy. I agree that I am powerless over it, and I believe that I could stop everything, but the pills were designed to addict you from within. Even if you only take them for 2 or 3 weeks straight, you're going to have some kind of blowback. Your body's going to withdraw. But I don't think it's just physical. I believe that a body is just a body, and the spirit is ultimately inside of the physical shell. And I don't think chemicals have anything to do with the spirit. They make the physical addiction to the body. But the root of the addiction comes from being really unhappy. That's a spiritual problem. After I left Scientology, I started upping the pills. I thought, oh my God, I've lost my religion, and it's been my only pavement to walk on, my replacement family. Everything was gone. All my friends, everything. I knew it was over. And I was so devastated, I used the drugs as a coping mechanism.
2 weeks into her new life in Nashville, my mother was back on opioids. The addiction got worse. She was drinking more, taking more opioids. At one point, she found an article that said cocaine can help people get off opioids. So she began to do cocaine to get off the opioids, and then opioids to get off the cocaine. Her addiction would continue through all of the stints in rehab on the basis that she was always in severe and life-threatening withdrawals that no doctor could understand. She felt all the doctors were too harsh. They wouldn't give her enough of what she needed, so she was doing it herself.
It escalated to 80 pills a day. It took more and more to get high, and I honestly don't know when your body decides it can't deal with it anymore. But it does decide that at some point. I believe that we're all born innocent and that everyone's nature is innately good, but they get fucked by their surroundings. And I believe that my brain is different, that I am an addict. Otherwise, I wouldn't have had all those years in between being a stupid teenager to suddenly getting a drug habit at 40. For a couple of years, it was recreational, and then it wasn't. It was an absolute matter of addiction, withdrawal in the big leagues. If I had fully run out of drugs, the severity of the withdrawal would have left me either in the hospital or dead. My blood pressure would shoot up so high, I just wanted to check out. It was too painful to be sober. My whole life had blown up. It felt like one thing after another, and I could not take any more beatings.
My mom came up with all kinds of reasons why she didn't want to get off drugs, but I think one of the most poignant ones was her feeling of shame about becoming an addict with two young children. Her parenting standards were so high that I don't think she could ever truly get sober knowing what she had put my sisters through. The one thing that she had always really prided herself on was that she was a great mother. She said, "My music wasn't that successful. I didn't finish high school. I'm not beautiful. I'm not good enough, but I'm a great mother." When she started to feel like she wasn't even that, she couldn't handle it. so she doubled down. When she lived in Nashville, in the depths of her addiction, my mom would often drive the 200 miles southwest to Graceland to sleep in her dad's bed. It seemed like the only place she found any comfort. Often she would take me, Ben, and my sisters upstairs to his room, and we would all sleep in her dad's bed while there were tours going on downstairs. I wish this was a magical time in a magical family place. But the truth of it was, she was in the house desperate to feel protected, desperate to connect with her father. She would lie in his bed, lie on his floor, anything to feel some comfort. It was the feeling of going to church when all is lost and saying, "Please, Jesus, help me." And every time she went, she'd point out an empty plot of grass where she would eventually be laid to rest, next to her father in the meditation garden. When I was back in LA, I got a call from my mother. "There's something wrong with me, physically," she said. "You need to come to LA," I said. "We need to get you to a hospital." That began a long text chain between me and my brother in LA and my mom in Nashville, excerpts of which I offer here. "Mom, please come get me out of here ASAP. We can find a trailer or something. We can get to California. I'm not kidding. I need you both. I don't have the strength to leave. I'm not well in any way. My legs and body are swollen. I spit up blood. My ankles are twisted. My lips are bleeding. I throw up everything but yogurt. My feet are so swollen I'm scared. Me. You need to go to the doctor now. You need to get checked up in vitamins. Go to the doctor now. This is not okay. Ben. She doesn't want to go to a doc. There's a doc that will go to the house. That's the best move right now. Me. My mom's assistant, Christy, and Lockwood are both saying you won't go to the doctor. You need to go to the doctor. Mom. Not a doctor here. Tennessee has strong laws. They'll take away my babies. Me. For drugs? Who cares? You're going to die. Mom, you just need a doctor to check your vitals. Ben. I don't care if the devil himself came to Earth and said he was a doctor, as long as he's a doctor. Mom. I have my doctors in LA I want to see. Me. Can I please get you an RV to drive you to LA tomorrow? Ben. Get in an RV and come here. Me. Mom, I'm booking an RV in Tennessee tomorrow. Ben will fly to Nashville and go with you and the babies. Ben. Answer, Mom. Ben. Mom, answer my fucking phone call. I've called you 21 times. If you don't want to talk to me, that's fine, but I have a plan. Me. Mom, Ben has a good plan. You'll take an RV with the babies. Mom, where do we stay? Me. I'll find you somewhere. Ben. Call me. 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 Call me.
I had done a bunch of blow and a shot of tequila and a bunch of pills. All that was mixed with stress. I was really unhappy and my body was not doing well. Riley and Ben wanted to get me to a doctor. Everyone wanted to get me to the doctor, but I wouldn't go to one in Nashville. So Riley sent Ben to get me because my assistant Christy had told her that a couple of times she thought I had gone, that I had looked dead on the bed. Ben showed up, and he and the girls and I took a tour bus all the way from Nashville to LA. We drove because I wanted to do cocaine the whole time and couldn't if I was on an airplane. I didn't think I could even get through airport security. The tour bus had 6 beds, a bedroom in the back, a kitchen. When we arrived in LA, I went straight in to see the head of Cedars-Sinai. I was at 30 heartbeats per minute. I lay there, scared to death. My echocardiogram came back bad. I was literally losing my heart. My heart was dead, just in pieces.
When she arrived in LA from Nashville, my mom's head and face were twice their normal size. She went straight from the emergency room to the ICU. She was in heart failure. It was chaos. In the midst of it, she told Michael Lockwood she was leaving him. It took about a week for her to start to recover. Once she was feeling a bit better, she was desperate to find somewhere safe, somewhere gated to live. She repeatedly asked if we could find somewhere in Mountain Gate, where we'd all lived when I was little, where we'd lost Jocko the pug, but where we'd been so happy. My mother had changed business management at that time, and somehow all of her credit cards had been frozen. She had nothing. Everything was a mess. She went to court-ordered rehab in LA, submitted to court-ordered P tests, the whole bit. The rehab gave her Suboxone and other drugs like Seroquel and Gabapentin to wean her off the opioids, but they only served to make her even more high because whatever the normal dose was, she would somehow get 5 times that amount from the doctors. When I would go visit her, she didn't even know who I was. I remember sitting with her while she tried to light her cigarette for 5 full minutes, unsuccessfully. It was as if it was all happening in slow motion. The cigarette was never closer than a foot away from the lighter. While in rehab, my mom had decided to get bariatric surgery. Her entire life, she had been harassed for being fat. The surgery was something she'd always wanted. It was a strange time to decide to have surgery in rehab. She wasn't done with her program. I remember worrying that it was a way to stay on medication a little bit longer. I didn't feel she was ready to be sober. If you have any experience with addicts, you'll know that when I questioned her about the timing of the surgery, it turned into a massive fight. That was a dead giveaway. Then she removed me from the guest list at the hospital. In the midst of her addiction, I was a narc to her. I was Pookie, her regular name for me. I was seldom, if ever, Riley. Not a pirate. I often found myself calling out her attempts to best the system. I would contact the doctors behind her back and tell them that they were overprescribing, but she was Lisa Marie Presley. And so she almost always prevailed and was furious that I'd tried to intervene. Bending doctors, anyone to her will, was a celebrity phenomenon that she was very aware of. She often told me that the issue with her father and with Michael Jackson was that everyone around them always just said yes. But of course, she didn't see the issue the same way when she was doing it herself. In the throes of her addiction, if you wanted to stop her, you were out. To me, she would say, "You don't understand. You're not an addict." Soon she was out of rehab, but incredibly depressed. She'd been through another separation, and she felt like she had nothing to live for, nothing to look forward to. She was on a bunch of medications that left her numb. All she could really do was sit on the couch and watch TV. For her to be able to see my sisters, there had to be a court-certified monitor present. I was that monitor. So for my sisters to move back in with her, my mom had to live with me. And as my brother lived with her, I got my brother as a bonus. So my mom, my sisters, and my brother moved into my 2,000-square-foot house in the valley. Then my dad moved in too. It seemed like it could have been good to have everyone together. But it felt like the end of things. We'd had this amazing, colorful, beautiful, abundant, fun, joyful life. But in that house, it took a turn and got unbearably dark for all of us. Japan was my brother's favorite country. When Ben and I were on the train to Kyoto, one day he said to me, half joking, kind of coyly, "It's so hard because when I do something new, I get really good at it so fast that it becomes uninspiring." Nothing kept his interest long because when he learned to do something, he actually would be good at it. He was one of those people who could annoyingly be great at everything. But he hadn't found the one thing that really grabbed him. He wanted to play guitar for a living. He'd taken business courses. He'd trained to be a sushi chef, even got a chef's knife tattooed on one arm, but nothing ever stuck. He was really smart, way more academic than I was. In his mid-20s, he began to feel pressure to make a choice. I was always trying to help him figure out what to do with his life. "You could move to Hawaii and fish," I'd say, another passion of his. We'd send each other links to houses on Redfin that he might one day buy. His dream was to live a simple life somewhere. Hawaii or Japan were his top choices. But when the conversation would progress, he'd always hit his reality. "I can't leave my mom." He, like the rest of us siblings, was privy to the tremendous deep sadness and loneliness of her. How she had ended up pushing away virtually everyone and everything she loved and was very much alone. And he'd given himself the responsibility of never leaving her side. In May 2018, I went to Tokyo to film a movie for Netflix called Earthquake Bird, and Ben came with me. Initially, we stayed in the Park Hyatt, the hotel that features in Lost in Translation. I'm not much of a drinker, but on my 29th birthday, I got way too drunk. I cannot handle my alcohol, and threw up all over the side of the hotel. I could hear my parents' voices in my head telling me what a lightweight I was. I probably only had 3 drinks. In a family of pirates, that's not necessarily a bad thing to be. My family took pride in their piracy, and they really lived up to it. But as my mother once said when I claimed I was hardcore, "Oh, Pookie, you are so not hardcore." The next week, we found an apartment to live in. Ben and I had the most beautiful time in Japan that month. We would wake up every day and head to the sauna or the steam room. Then we'd take a walk to get smoothies and just keep wandering. I had some yellow Nikes I wore around the city that he was obsessed with. He never wanted anything I had other than those shoes. I didn't have much to do in the movie, so there was time. I had an assistant, Shusaku, and he and Ben became best friends. When I did have to work, the two of them would run around the city together. Tokyo is a beautiful place for ceramics, so we went to ceramics classes, the three of us. We made so many pots and bowls and cups, Shu translating for us. Ben was a foodie. We'd go out to all these incredible omakase restaurants, and he would eat everything and anything. There were dishes that I would not eat, sea urchin, for example. But with the chef right there, I didn't want to be rude, so I'd wait for the chef to look away, then slip whatever it was I couldn't stomach to Ben. Despite Ben being so into the best food, one of his favorite things to eat were rice balls from 7-Eleven. In fairness, the food at 7-Elevens in Japan is very good. We'd take the rice balls to Zushi Beach, a surfer beach about an hour south of the city. We'd climb the mountain to a shrine, me and my bright yellow Nike sneakers, banana shoes as Ben called them, and eat rice balls. Ben would give me a hard time about the shoes every day. "Did you get my banana shoes yet?" he'd asked repeatedly. And I promised over and over that I'd get him a pair. For a while, Ben got heavily into making jewelry. A few weeks after I started dating the man who would become my husband, Ben Smith Peterson, we were all in Ireland together. Ben told Ben, my mom later christened the two Ben and Big Ben to differentiate, that it was obvious that he was going to propose to me. We were children, but we were clearly going to be together, and that he'd make a ring. A few weeks later, Big Ben was in Australia visiting his mom. She mentioned that she had some diamonds that she'd taken out of her great-grandmother's ring. She'd intended to repurpose them into something for herself, but she gave him one of them. Back in the States, Ben found a vintage ring with no setting and set the diamond for Big Ben. Big Ben then attached the ring to our dog and told me to call him over. And that's how he, well, technically the dog, proposed. Back in LA, while trying to look after our mother, Ben's own addiction to alcohol was growing. And as it grew, so did his depression. Though he suffered from anxiety, sober or not, when he wasn't drinking, he was often fine. His depression didn't seem dangerous. He would sometimes go on a bender and he would sometimes do drugs, take Molly for a week and feel the come down. But after a few days away from it, he was back to normal. My mom was such a powerful person that whatever she was doing really affected all of us. Our lives were dictated by the tone she was setting, and that tone became very heavy and hopeless. Our mom, the queen, the fiercest of the family leaders, had fallen down. I had mistakenly thought she was so strong-minded that nothing could ever truly hobble her. But of course it could. Enough pain can hobble anyone. She'd been addicted to drugs for the better part of a decade, and the drugs created a sense of hopelessness that permeated everything. She stopped wanting to do anything. She felt like her life was over. She'd say, "I have nothing. I have no husband. I have no friends. I have no life." She was bottoming out. Ben Ben was a mama's boy through and through, and he couldn't handle his mama being in pain. They were so close, like Elvis and Gladys, one inextricably tied to the rise and fall of the other, and seeing each other in pain was impossibly hard for them. It wrecked them. What had once felt like a perfect childhood to us gave way to what felt like a nightmare to him. Like many in our family, substances were where Ben found relief, and his alcohol addiction got worse. Sometimes I'd think, well, he doesn't seem like he's drinking that much more than other friends of mine. In fact, from that standpoint, he was not even the one I was most concerned about. We were very tight, but he didn't tell me how bad he was really feeling. One day, he told my mom that he didn't think he was mentally okay, but she didn't tell me that. And you wouldn't have known unless he told you. We were all very close, forever cuddling, curled up in bed together. So when it got dark, how could it not affect all of us? All of our lives, my mother had been leading the way, and none of us could get used to her not having her usual strength. The drugs she stayed on after rehab were dimming her light. The following year, my mom was able to move into her own house in Calabasas, and my brother and sisters moved in with her. I swear that house was haunted. It felt cursed. Or maybe it was how powerful my mother's moods had become. She wouldn't go a few days without seeing me, but I didn't want to be there. The house felt so heavy. My brother could feel it. Anyone who went there could feel it. Ben Ben finally decided he was drinking too much, so my mom sent him to rehab. But on his return, he was still stuck in that terrible house, watching his mother struggle. She was not truly sober either. She wasn't taking narcotics, but she was certainly getting high on the post-rehab cocktail. We would fight about it all the time. And she would get vicious, protecting her addiction. Otherwise, she would just sleep on the couch all day. It was incredibly hard for my brother to watch. Then she had a seizure. My brother and her assistant were home with her at the time. Ben Ben stayed by her side until the paramedics arrived. I showed up that night to take care of my sisters. My mom was in the hospital. Ben was sitting on the couch in silence. "Are you okay?" I asked. "Yep," he said, as though he was completely checked out. I had my attention on the twins. They had just seen the paramedics wheel their mother out and were very upset, so I wasn't able to check on my brother. After the seizure, my mother realized she couldn't do this anymore. Though she remained on mood stabilizers, she did manage to truly sober up. One day she said to me, "That's enough. I really need to change my life." She had been very chastened by the seizure. In fact, she had a deep phobia about them. One time in a mall in Florida when I was around 7 years old, a man was having a violent seizure on the floor. My mother couldn't shake the image of it for months and eventually had to get therapy about it. When she told me that she'd had enough, I remember thinking, finally. Her addiction was going to be gone, and I really felt it was. But I noticed that my brother's disposition had changed after the seizure. He seemed quieter and was often alone in his room. I remember feeling like I wanted to check on him more than usual, because I knew that seeing his mother have a seizure would have been unbearable for him. That haunted house in Calabasas had developed a minor mold problem, so my mom, Ben, and my sisters were staying at the Beverly Hills Hotel while the problem was remediated. My mom was badly allergic to mold. During their stay, Ben went back to the house one night to throw a birthday party for his girlfriend. My mom and Ben were texting back and forth that night. She had picked up something about his mindset, something that worried her. "Are you coming back tomorrow? Come home," she wrote. At the house, the party went into the small hours. Everyone was happily hanging out downstairs. Ben went upstairs around 3:30 a.m. "Come home," she wrote. He said he was just going to get a beer.
"We're talking about suicide. We're talking about addiction. These are things that my son struggled with, to help people that are suicidal or that have misconceptions about suicide, because they do. I did."